Welcome to Rethink, a podcast focused on the future of skilled nursing. I'm Sahida Siddiqui, editor at Skilled Nursing News. I'm joined today by Jason Murray, CEO and co-founder of PAX Group, who has been in the nursing home sector for the past 25 years. He started out as a CNA and went on to co-found the Utah-based nursing home giant about 13 years ago, eventually leading to its public debut on Wall Street in June 2024. Over time, Murray has watched patient acuity rise, but that hasn't stopped him from building PAX into a legacy company. However, after PAX went public in 2024, it quickly found itself at the center of an investigation into its billing practices. That experience sparked what Murray now calls, quote, a culture of compliance, close quote, within the company, he told Skilled Nursing News. Over the past 18 months, teams across the organization have worked to make compliance a core value, he said. To support this effort, PAX has added resources at the central office to develop and share policies, procedures, and key guardrails for local operators. The results, well, they speak for themselves. But before we dive into that conversation, I'd like to highlight the first ever Payer Summit taking place June 17th to June 18th in Chicago. The summit will explore how shifting payment models are reshaping the market for skilled nursing and home health. Visit skillednursingnews.com/events to find out more. And now, my conversation with Jason Murray. Jason Murray, welcome to the Rethink podcast. Starting with the general outlook for PAX, what is your vision for PAX over the next 3 to 5 years in terms of geographic reach, service lines, and scale?
Yeah, so I think that PAX, we're really just getting started. When I think about the future, we've been around for 13 years now. And, over that 13 years, we've made tremendous progress and strides in developing a foundation that that we expect to endure a very long time. My business partner and I started the company. We did so with the idea that we wanted to build a legacy company, and that required a lot of effort to in the foundation of that company. And I think over that last 13 years, we've been doing that. We've been strengthening the foundation, and now as I think of the future, we have that infrastructure in place now to where we can start to go vertical, using that same metaphor of building, where we're in the early innings of what we're doing, and it's an exciting time for our company because there's ample opportunity for us to continue to spread our influence in a sector that desperately needs it. And what I mean by that is that, we take a lot of pride in the work that we do. We like to think that we're very good at what we do. And I think the quality metrics that are available publicly and that we measure every single day, I think those indicate and show that we are, that we're strong as an operator. And, as we think about quality, as we improve quality within a facility, we're also improving an individual's life, a patient's life, an employee's life as well. And that's highly motivating to us. And it's really a part of our mission as an organization as well. So that's when I think about, adding value to the sector, that's what I mean by that is adding higher quality in the facilities that we operate. And by doing so, positively impacting patients' lives in a way that's meaningful. So we'll continue to grow and expand that influence across the sector in the future years. We also, your question about, service lines and things of that nature, the way that we think about that is that we really want to have as much touch on the patient post-acute as possible. And the reason that's important to us is because it allows us to help control the outcomes. And that's important for upstream, for our referring partners. If we can do a good job managing the outcomes of those patients when they, potentially when they leave the facility and they go to a lower level of care, if we can have touch on that patient and control of the outcome of that patient, ultimately, you know, we feel like we can have better outcomes for our patients. And so I think that's what you'll see as well in the future, as we'll continue to evaluate. And with skilled nursing being our core business, there will be other opportunities for us to expand our reach to have as much touch on our patients as much touch as possible.
Right. And this next question kind of connects with what you're saying. You've mentioned before that the services at PACS facilities and the post-acute care industry as a whole really function like an extension of hospital care. Can you dive a bit deeper into that idea and share how PACS is weaving this approach into your main goals and objectives as you look ahead to 2026?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, just as I reflect back on my career over, you know, I've been doing this now for almost, actually it's been 25 years. And when I first started in the industry there, it looked a lot different than it does today. And, you know, the types of patients that we would see, it was not common for us to see like higher acuity patients. You know, those were reserved for the hospital or for the LTACs and other kind of specialty hospitals to take care of. And, you know, over that 25 years, I've seen this steady shift. And I know others have seen it as well, where we're getting the patient out of the higher cost setting, which is the hospital, and getting them into a lower cost setting, and yet still expecting high quality clinical outcomes. And so this movement, this evolution that you know I've seen, and I know others have seen, our sector has seen it for sure. You know, that evolution is something that we've really tried to embrace. And what that looks like for us is that we've invested heavily in our personnel, invested heavily in the training and in the tools that they need, the equipment that they need to take care of those higher acuity patients. And so, you know, it's important in the markets where we operate that we understand what the needs are of those local markets. Every market is different. There's a lot of nuance in every market where we operate. It could be in the same state. And it could be, you know, maybe a different zip code, but it's different in the way that we operate that facility. And so our decentralized, locally led, centrally supported model that we deploy, you know, helps us stay in tune with what is going on in the local markets. And then that being in tune with that allows us to adapt and create business plans to support the needs of that local market. And as we do that, you know, what we are finding is we are seeing more and more acuity flow into the facilities. And so we have to be really good as providers and as a company to continue to make that adaptation and to continue to make sure that we're sharp with our skill sets within our facilities to take care of those higher acuity patients. Because I don't see that changing, you know, anytime soon, especially as we think about you know, healthcare expenditures and, you know, an aging population and demographic and access, all of those are reasons why, you know, skilled nursing will continue to be a very viable option and frankly necessary for the post-acute healthcare continuum.
Great. So turning to star ratings and clinical excellence, nearly 3/4 of your skilled nursing facilities achieved 4 or 5 star ratings. What are the key operational or clinical practices that have driven these high quality outcomes consistently across your portfolio?
Yeah, so I think I'm glad that you mentioned that because we're very proud of the clinical metrics that we've been able to achieve across our portfolio. Again, mind you, those are, you know, we take our business model is to take underperforming facilities and to turn them around, to improve them clinically, operationally, financially. And as we take care of the fundamentals of running a nursing home, which a nursing home is exactly that, we are providing nursing care, clinical care. That's what we do. That's our product. And as we execute on that effectively and have strong clinical outcomes, we start to see, you know, more and more. We start to see the transformation of that facility accelerate, and we start to see improvements across a lot of different metrics accelerate. And so for us, priority number one is care and making sure that we are investing in the in the quality care of in the facilities where we operate. And when I talk about, you know, the question is, what strategies do we deploy? You know, the investment piece is an important piece, and you know, we've invested significantly in our facilities, and we'll continue to do so in providing our clinicians the tools that they need and our operating teams the tools that they need to improve care. You cannot improve what you cannot see. And so it's been important for us to provide visibility from a technology standpoint for our people. And so what that looks like in our portfolio and in our facilities is that we have a very sophisticated dashboard that is accessible to our clinicians. Handheld devices, you know, whatever tool that is helpful for them, we try to provide that to give them access and data that is real-time data to allow them to make the necessary adjustments to improve care. That investment in technology has been key for us in maintaining higher, you know, high clinical scores. And, you know, we've invested a lot of resources over the years in that, you know, with the expectation that it would yield the results that we want it to. And we've been able to see that. And so that's an important strategy of ours. And we'll continue to devote resources, you know, into not only our existing facilities, but new facilities as we acquire them.
And we'll get later into, you know, some of the staffing strategies and your EIT programs. But before we turn to that, I wanted to ask about some other metrics. And one of the ones that stood out, of course, for everyone in your earnings call, the latest earnings call, was occupancy levels. Occupancy at mature facilities is almost 95%. What strategies drive such high utilization at PACS?
So again, that's another metric. I'm glad you raised that. We're very proud of our quality measure scores across our portfolio. We're very proud of our occupancy percentage as well, because the way that I think about it is that those two go hand in hand. And as we work hard to execute and make sure that we are strong clinically in our facilities, and as that becomes priority number one when we walk in day one, is to improve the clinical outcomes of that facility. As we do that, and as I mentioned earlier, it really does create kind of a virtuous cycle, and we start to see metrics across the whole facility and the whole portfolio improve, and so as we lead with care, and as we strive to be, you know, the very best in the markets where we operate in the care category, then what happens is we become more, you know, sophisticated with the way that we share that information with providers, with stakeholders. We start to see the referral patterns change, and we start to see more and more patients, and then you start to see higher acuity patients that are reimbursing higher than a traditional patient, and so it does create this virtuous cycle that leads to higher occupancy in our facilities. And so again, those two things in my eyes go hand in hand, and as we can tackle the clinical outcomes in our facilities and do a good job there, we expect that our occupancy will run high, and that's proven true over the last, you know, many years we've been doing this, and it's very hard to have the inverse of that where you have high occupancy but low quality scores. That's very difficult, if not impossible, to if not do maintain for sure, and so it's very important that our fundamentals are strong in our facilities, and if we do that right, then you know we have no reason to believe that we can't run 95 and above occupancy in the markets where we operate.
And I was going to ask you about technological innovation across the industry and what specific tools or technologies do you use to achieve both clinical and operational success? I think you mentioned dashboards, handheld devices. Are there any others?
Yeah, so I mean, we have invested heavily in this area over the years. You know, I would put it in the category of probably pushing, you know, $100 million or so in the lifetime of our company, in investing in technologies in our facilities and in the home office to have visibility into the clinical processes of our facilities and the clinical outcomes of our facilities. And so, you know, we do have the items that I mentioned, you know, the handheld devices, the point of care devices. You know, we have a standardization across our portfolio of a clinical record that is, an EMR that is consistent from facility to facility. That's one of the first priorities that we tackle when we are doing a new acquisition, is that we deploy our model, our clinical model, our clinical technology model into those facilities, which oftentimes requires us to, we've trenched new like data lines, internet, into a facility so we can get higher speed internet in order for us to run the types of technologies that we'd like to run. Putting up just basic things that you wouldn't think of, like that are very basic, like wireless routers and computers, all of those things help provide the access that our clinicians need and the visibility that our clinicians need and our operations teams need in order to improve on the clinical front. So those are the strategies that we've deployed. There are nuances within the clinical record or EMR that certain facilities have taken advantage of to even further improve their capacity and ability to take care of higher acuity patients, to have visibility into that. But I would say it really begins with the EMR across our portfolio and ensuring that each of our facilities has the infrastructure that it needs to run the clinical platforms that we've created to ensure that we have the visibility that we need to affect change.
Sounds good. Anything that reduces burdens, or any of your technology or AI tools that you use, do you make sure that they're not adding to the burdens for staff?
It's a really good question, and it's something that we have to be sensitive to, especially when we're doing a new acquisition. It's not uncommon, as I mentioned, for us when we do a new acquisition to find that, they are significantly behind the technological curve, as it were, where they could still be doing paper charting as they take care of their patients, and that is challenging, right? I mean, that's the world that I came from 25 years ago, and we've seen this evolution and change, which has been a good change because it has, I think, improved the work streams of our clinicians and made them more efficient. But when we're doing these acquisitions, oftentimes we find clinicians who have lived in that world for so long that this idea of adapting to a computer to document their care can be a bit of a learning curve. And so to your point, it can be a bit of a heavy lift early on to help educate and train these nurses who have been nurses for a very long time and are very capable, but that is one obstacle that they have is their ability to adapt to this new technology. It's typically the older nurses, the ones who have been nurses for a very long time, who have been maybe a little reluctant to embrace the technology changes that our sector has been going through. So those are the outliers where it does create probably a little more of a burden in the short term for those clinicians to learn and adapt. But in large part, it's created greater efficiencies for our nurses. You mentioned AI. We have an AI committee where we're constantly evaluating different tools that potentially could make us more efficient with the work that we do. I'm sure it's just a matter of time until we're able to adopt more of these technologies and deploy them. I mean, we like to think that we try to be really cutting edge for the work that we do. And we kind of say it tongue in cheek that we are the most technologically advanced skilled nursing company in the history of skilled nursing. And I think that the bar is pretty low there. So, we can say that, but we are all constantly looking for opportunities to make our clinicians, especially with the workforce, the workforce, the way it is today with clinicians and the potential, shortages that are there. It's important that we keep them efficient. And so technology is one great way to do that.
Yeah, you're right, too. From my discussions with other operators, it seems like the industry is still has a lot to catch up on that technological front. So turning to value-based care and reimbursement, how is PACS positioning itself to leverage value-based care opportunities? And what role do quality metrics such as rehospitalization rates play in shaping your reimbursement and growth strategy?
So, you know, again, as I mentioned earlier, everything begins and ends with care in our facilities. I mean, that's the way that we think about the work that we do within our facilities, is that we have to be really good at providing high quality care to our patients. And as we do that, and as we see our quality metrics improve, not only our quality measure scores, our overall quality rating as well, but also, like you mentioned, you know, things like rehospitalization, you know, wounds, you know, falls, all of those are key metrics that we measure every single day, multiple times throughout the day. And again, that we give visibility to our clinicians and our operating teams to make sure that they can make the necessary adjustments to improve. So we've done, I think, a good job in this area of giving that visibility, but then also being able to collect that data and share that data with stakeholders. So I think that's important, especially in value-based purchasing and other programs that tie reimbursement to quality. As we continue to perform well clinically, you know, we will have a good position in our negotiations in those different programs. And so, again, that's the way that we think about it, is that we need to be, priority number one is care. And as we get that right, if we're continuing to, you know, it's important for us to understand what value-based programs are out there. And so that's the way we talk about it in our company, is that, you know, let's get care right, obviously, and let's make sure we're improving across all the important clinical KPIs. But let's also be aware. And this is all part of being a good partner in the markets where we operate, the individual communities where we operate, is we need to be a good partner there. We need to understand, we need to have relationships with the stakeholders in the markets where we operate. We also need to have that across the country from a centralized standpoint. So what that does, it allows us to understand what different programs are out there, and it allows us to evaluate those programs. And if we're performing well clinically, what we have found is that we always have a seat at the table to have a conversation around whether or not we want to participate. Some we've passed on. Others we've done pilot programs with. Others we are currently in value-based purchasing programs. And they are, you know, the way we like to think about this is anything that ties reimbursement to quality, we embrace, because we feel like we do really well from a quality standpoint. And so, you know, we are optimistic when we go into markets and we see, you know, value-based purchasing, or we see any other type of reimbursement mechanism that's tied to quality. We like that because we feel like we perform really well in those areas.
What would you like to see from the policy standpoint? Anything, you mentioned that you embrace changes or to value-based care. Any ideas that you have for policymakers?
I mean, I've got a lot of ideas. You know, I'm not sure, you know, how many of them would be potentially interesting to policymakers. But, you know, I don't know if this is specific to, you know, value-based care. But, you know, one thing that has been, I think, a challenge for our sector is the 3-day midnight qualifying stay in the acute setting, right? In order for a patient to access their Medicare benefit. We saw, and that's been around for a very long time. And, you know, what we have, during COVID-19, that actually went away, right? There was a waiver program where that went away, and it improved access into the skilled nursing facilities for patients. And so that's one thing I would love to see change. Where, you know, as we talk about the level of acuity and the ability of providers to adapt, and if they are good at taking care of higher acuity patients, why not stabilize them at the hospital and then discharge them to a lower level of care setting, albeit they have the capability to take care of that higher acuity patient, but they're also doing it for a fraction of the cost of a hospital. I used to be a hospital administrator working in acute care before we started the company. And I understand, like, the cost associated with an acute stay is significant as it relates to the cost in staying in a skilled nursing facility. So, you know, it is literally a fraction. A skilled nursing facility is the lowest cost institutional setting to receive care in the post-acute healthcare continuum. And so, you know, I think that that payers understand that. I think the government, I don't know if they fully understand it, but you know, if I could have my way, that would be one policy that I would have them reconsider, because I think it makes good sense for from a quality standpoint for our patients, quality of life standpoint for our patients, I would say as well, and for the overall healthcare sector and just healthcare spending in general, it would significantly decrease that that component that the of that three midnight qualifying stay that just adds cost to the healthcare system that we could eliminate.
Definitely. We've heard a lot about that. Turning to growth strategy, PACS has grown rapidly through acquisitions. How do you decide which facilities fit your model? And also in terms of like the model, I'm wondering about, as a comparison to some other sector leaders who may have like cluster models, could you delve a little bit deeper into that as well?
Sure. So, you know, over the years, I think we've gotten better at evaluating deals, and you know, we have you know, this is all part of, I would say, the maturation of our company over the last 13 years, is we've matured in a lot of different areas, and this is one of those areas where we've made tremendous progress, and so we have a whole M&A team. And they are backed by technology as well that allows us the visibility that we need into doing a proper underwriting of the markets that we are evaluating and the facilities that we're evaluating. So all of that information that we use for our underwriting, it essentially distills down into a scorecard system. And we've been able to scorecard states, certain geographies within states, submarkets within those categories. It gives us the ability to be more intentional with our growth and to know what states we want to target, what geographies within those states we want to target. And more importantly, it tells us, you know, which states we should hold off on and wait until, you know, things potentially change. So that whole process, the whole underwriting process it's been much more sophisticated over the last several years, and it's allowed us to be better informed with the way that we grow. So that's the first part of your question, and I guess the second part is you ask about, you know, our structure and how we support that growth. You know, our model is one where we have our individual, you know, administrators, facility administrators. They are, again, we use the term locally led, centrally supported. So our locally led facilities have an individual administrator, and they have their interdisciplinary teams that operate the facilities. Every one of those facilities are report up into a region. And those regions have a regional vice president, and they have a whole clinical team as well behind them to help support, again, centrally support the local administrators and the directors of nursing and their teams with their business plans. And then from there, those report up those regions. And we have, I believe, 17 in our portfolio today. And those report up to kind of an east and a west division. And that's the kind of the org chart of our operating team.
Got it. And staffing actually is at the center of the success of this model, if I'm not wrong, right? So what strategies do you employ to retain optimal staffing across your facility network?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. That would be, I would say, one of the biggest challenges that our sector faces, and I would say our company, you know, faces as well, is the workforce. You know, we have an aging demographic, and we have a finite number of clinicians that can take care of those people. And you know, so it's been this has been a strategy of ours for a very long time that we want to be the location of choice for the workforce. And we think that our decentralized model, where having our administrators keeping healthcare local and having our administrators laser focused on high quality care and in being good partners in the markets where we operate, and as they continue to perform well and as their reputation grows and improves, And as we become the provider of choice in the markets where we operate, we also want to be that same provider of choice for employers, for employees. And it takes a strategy from our administrators to find those clinicians and to attract the best of those clinicians. As we talk about this, the higher level of acuity and taking care of higher acuity patients, we have to have the right skill set within the facility to do that. And so our administrators, I think, and our directors of nursing have been very good at being able to create these destination locations for employees to want to be. And that's been important for us. And it's been a key strategy of our ability to run at, as you mentioned, 95% occupancy in some of our, you know, in our mature facilities across our portfolio. You don't get to that point without having the appropriate staffing to take care of not only the level of acuity, but take care of that number of patients. And so that's, you know, that's important to us. But then I would also say that's call it on the clinician front. You know, we also have some programs centrally on the clinician front as well to help develop nurses. So if like career development, for example, if we have a CNA that wants to become a nurse, there's a program for that. If we have a nurse that wants to become a director of nursing, there's a program for that. And so that's important because it creates some stickiness and helps, you know, our current staff feel like there is a path for improvement in their current job. And then on the administrator front, that's another area where, you know, I would call this a competitive advantage that we have over our competitors, is that, you know, our ability to attract and retain what we feel is the very best in the industry has been a key strategy of ours over the years. And I think it's a big differentiating factor between us and others, is the caliber of leaders that we have in our organization. That's been frankly key to our success.
Good segue into your AIT program. How has the administrator and training program at PACS supported the integration of new facilities, and what lessons have you learned in maintaining operational continuity during rapid expansion?
So as I mentioned, this really has been a competitive advantage of ours. And over the years, we've really worked hard to be very intentional with our strategy of attracting the right type of person into our company. And so we've been fortunate to create a culture over the years of this kind of relentless pursuit of excellence, is what I like to call it. And as we go out and talk with potential administrators and potential leaders of our company, that's an important understanding that they need to have. And it's something that we need to be able to read and feel that those candidates have that same, they're like-minded in the way that they think about improvement. And so, you know, the strategies that we've deployed is that we've worked with local universities in the markets where we operate, and we have and we go after the best and the brightest in those universities. And I'm not talking about the best and the brightest looking to get into nursing homes. I'm talking about the best and the brightest in the programs, period. And these are people that may not have thought about nursing homes as a job. And as we target those individuals, and again, as I say, we're very intentional with the way we do this, as we go after and recruit those individuals, you know, we can share with them who we are. We can share with them the culture of our company as well. And for the right candidate, that resonates. And they really like this idea of being able to impact a person's life in an industry that in a way that no other industry can. And again, for the right person, that resonates. And they can do that. They can be the captains of their destiny and their facilities where they operate as they execute on their business plans. It's a bottoms-up approach with how we do our budgeting, with how we do the quality within the facility as well. They are the ones who manage all of that. And to be challenged with that, both, you know, intellectually and professionally, you know, that can be intriguing for the right candidate. And then also to make a very good living doing it, you know, all of that together can make it very enticing for the right candidate. So we've been very fortunate to find some very good leaders in our organization through our AIT program That's critical for us when we talk about growth, because we take underperforming facilities, right? And they're broken in many ways. And oftentimes what we have found is that the leadership function within a facility is not strong. And so, you know, our AIT pool is what we use to bring in new leadership into those facilities. And you can imagine if you have this, you know, highly motivated person who is, you know, frankly, never satisfied with being as good as where they are. They want to be the best at what they do. When they come in, they breathe in a new life into that facility. And as we centrally provide the appropriate resources that they need from a clinical standpoint and, you know, the tools, the technology that we've talked about, and the guardrails from a compliance standpoint, you know, we let them go to work. And we've seen some tremendous success that way in finding the right candidates and fitting them with the right opportunities. And as we see, you know, we've just seen some amazing things as we've worked that same model now many, many times over the last 13 years. So that's really, you know, key to our success.
So just to clarify, so do you promote, you know, people from within the organizations to become AITs, or is it more of like recruiting a pool and have these AIT candidates in waiting, so to speak?
So we really do both, right? So there are, and I'm glad you bring that up, because just like with our directors of nursing, right? If there's a good, you know, a nurse or even a CNA that wants to become a director of nursing, we will create a path for that. There is a path for that. And we want them to feel like there is career progression. And so we've done the same for administrators. If we have a very solid, promising talent within a facility that wants to become an administrator, there is absolutely a path for that. I would say that if I had to guess, and this would completely be a guess, the majority of our AITs come from outside of our existing employees. And so, you know, we're heavy on recruitment in that front, but it doesn't mean that we don't provide those opportunities for our current employees.
Got it. And this next question, and I don't know if it's a little bit redundant with what you've already said, but how does the PACS AIT program differ from standard programs in the industry? What tactics have you used to drive its success?
Yeah, so, you know, I look back when we were developing our AIT program, you know, I've been an administrator for quite some time. You know, I've sat in the seat and like to think that I have a pretty good sense for what it's like to be a facility administrator. I started off as a CNA. And so, you know, I like to think I have a pretty good idea of what it's like to take care of a patient as well and provide direct care. So that was really our past experience when we started the company. You know, Mark and I, we were both administrators, and we were really just kind of referring back to our experiences of what we went through when we did our AIT program. And it was, you know, it's interesting because you learn, you know, I think how not to do things sometimes, and that informs you on how to make a good decision. And, you know, I was fortunate to have a very good AIT program, but there were also areas where I wish I could have learned more. And so I think what we've really worked hard to do over the years is develop a program that gives our administrators in training real exposure to what it's like to be an administrator. So it isn't that you are, you know, just sitting in an office every day, you know, studying and trying to understand, you know, all the policies and regulations, which, you know, you could do that forever because, you know, we're so heavily regulated. But there is a component of that for sure, but there has to be a solid mix of real life experiences. And so, you know, we let our administrators in training have those types of experiences in the facilities where they are working. And our administrators, our preceptors, those who are overseeing the AIT program for that AIT, they're very good, and there's a structure behind. They're giving them that exposure and letting them, you know, be the voice in meetings, running meetings, you know, giving them a chance to make decisions with the oversight of the preceptor. And see how their decisions impact the outcomes of the facility. You know, those are all like real life experiences that they really need to experience in order to I think not only for them to feel comfortable that they can do the job, but for us as well as a company to feel comfortable that they are right for that position. Because there have been a few times where we have found that, you know, people either, you know, self-elect to leave, or we find that they're just not the right fit as they've gone through the AIT program and as we've given them the exposure to kind of the real world experiences of an administrator. You know, there's been some weeding out done there. So that's the whole purpose of the AIT program anyway. And so, yeah, those are some of the strategies that we've used.
I wanted to ask you too, from your perspective, why is keeping care locally focused important for you?
Well, it's because, as I said earlier, you know, healthcare is local, and that's a tagline that we use in our company a lot. And what we mean by that is that, you know, every market is different. Every single market is different. You could be in the same state, and like I said, you could be just in a different zip code. But even if you're separated by a few miles, the dynamics of the stakeholders in that market are different. And so, you know, we need to be good as a company at adapting to the local needs of the market. And the best way that we can do that is to empower our local leaders in those markets to be aware of what's going on and to be empowered to make decisions to create a business plan to help support that need in the market. So you know, what I found is I've worked in the other models as well, where it's more centralized. The decisions are centralized and the administrator becomes more of a, you know, he executes the vision of a central office. And that is ineffective, in my opinion, because, you know, it's so difficult for you to be agile. It's so difficult for you to adjust your business plan when, you know, the person who's making the business plan lives 1,500 miles away. So that's why it's important to us. We knew when we started the company that this was a critical part to, you know, what we wanted to build. And as we started to scale as a company, this was another conversation point that we wanted to make sure we were very careful to not grow so quickly or to a size where we lose that idea that healthcare is local and we lose that that local autonomy that our administrators need to make good decisions, of course, supported by a central office, but they should feel empowered and have the tools that they need to make good decisions. That's how you achieve 95% occupancy in your mature facilities. That's how you achieve, you know, 3 to 4 star, 5 star ratings in your quality measures. That's how you do that. And you know, we'll continue to stay, you know, committed to that model moving forward.
Turning to SEC compliance, PACS became publicly traded in 2024. How does PACS foster a culture of compliance across its network of facilities? And what practices do you employ to ensure accordance with industry, state, and federal standards while also empowering local leadership?
Yeah, you're right. So going public in 24, you know, that was leading up to that. There was a lot of preparation that the company did to get to that point. And we knew, you know, once we became public, that we were going to have even additional opportunity to continue to improve and professionalize the way that we do things. And, you know, that's one area you talk about compliance, you know, over, I would call it even the last 18 months, where we have worked hard to strengthen the compliance function within the organization. And I think that where we've arrived now is that it isn't now a separate function within the organization. It is weaved through our operators. It's weaved into the culture and into the DNA of who we are as a company. And that was important. I think we were partially there before, but you know, we really wanted to make sure that that we had a culture of compliance across the organization. And so, you know, we've worked hard to build that out. We've added resources at the central office level to help build out the compliance function. And, you know, they've been great to help cascade down, you know, policies, procedures, and more importantly, guardrails, right, for our local operators to operate within. And I've been very, very pleased with the way that our operating team have received this initiative. And as I said, and that's why I can say that it's now part of our DNA, is because there's been such an embrace of this movement in the organization. Our people have really embraced this idea of having, you know, additional support to do their jobs and do it well and do it safely, and to know that they are, you know, as they operate within those guardrails, that they're in a safe zone. You know, that just creates confidence in the markets where we operate. And so that's been very important to us. And, you know, the organization, as I've mentioned before, like maturity, you know, that's over the last 18 months, particularly in that area, we've accelerated our maturity as a company, and it's been very encouraging to see.
Great. And how is PAX ensuring post-acute care remains affordable and accessible, even as demands increase and Medicare Advantage shifts in prominence?
So, you know, I think where we sit in the continuum today, as I mentioned earlier, you know, skilled nursing already is a very low-cost setting to receive institutional care. It is the lowest-cost setting to receive institutional care in the post-acute healthcare continuum. And so, you know, it's important as we think about MA, you know, moving forward, and, you know, we've been dealing with MA for a very long time now. You know, we have to get comfortable with this idea of doing more with less. And I think what that looks like for us as an organization is we continue to invest in technology that allows us to become more and more efficient. And as we attract the right talent into the organization as well, you know, an A player can do the work of two B players, three B players, right? And so as we bring in A players into our organization, they're high performing people that work efficiently. And, you know, by doing that, you know, that brings healthcare costs down, right? As we do more with less, and, you know, that with MA and just with, you know, budgets in general, you know, we're always dealing with Medicaid. We're always dealing with Medicare as well. And, you know, and looking at the reimbursement horizon for all of those different payers, you know, what we talk about internally with our company is we just need to make sure that we are very good at providing high quality care. And if we can continue to do that and do it well, and as we continue to invest in technology and adapt, you know, important, you know, potential AI tools and things of that nature, it just allows us to become more and more efficient. And as we do that, like, I guess I'll just use MA as an example really quick. If we embrace MA and as we, you know, work to develop business strategies around taking, you know, more patients who have, you know, maybe a shorter length of stay, but if you're good at taking that shorter length of stay, and if you're good at providing high quality outcomes with that lower length of stay patient whose level of acuity is very high, you know, you can replace those days with volume, in our opinion. And so, you know, that provider, that MA provider will, you know, refer more patients to you. That's what we have found over the years, is that we can replace, you know, potential lost revenue through MA contracts with lengths of stay and that whatnot through volume. And, you know, that's been a strategy of ours. So again, but it all begins with care. We need to be really good at providing high quality care and being able to share that data with the payers.
Got it. That's interesting. Thanks for clarifying that. In terms of like challenges ahead, what do you see as the biggest challenge or challenges facing PACS in 2026, and how is the company preparing to address them while sustaining growth and quality standards?
I guess I'll go back to what I said earlier, which is the workforce. Right, we have a finite number of clinicians, and we have an aging demographic that we need to take care of in the post-acute continuum, and that's challenging, right? That in itself, thinking of the number of patients that we need to take care of, and a workforce that, you know, may not be growing at the same scale, like that becomes an inherent challenge. And so, you know, for us, we want to be the employer of choice in the markets where we operate. As I mentioned before, like there's a whole strategy around this that our facilities deploy. There's a whole strategy around this that the company deploys as well, to be the employer of choice. And so, you know, as we can continue to win in that area, you know, we'll be able to continue to staff our buildings appropriately, make sure that we have the level of skills that we need to take care of that higher level of acuity patient to maintain higher occupancy levels. So, you know, that will continue to be a challenge going into 26 and beyond, is we need to continue to stay sharp in that area of being the employer of choice in the markets where we operate.
And we've come to almost the end of our podcast, and I wanted to ask you this question that we ask all of our guests. This podcast is called Rethink. What's something that you think leaders in the nursing home SNF sector need to rethink?
You know, I think, yeah, I will maybe point to two things. First would just be what I just mentioned about the workforce. And, you know, I think my experience has been that, you know, providers are not always super intentional with the way that they recruit employees. And, you know, I remember one executive a long time ago who told me that we were trying to hire a few nurses, and you know, he used this term, do they pass the fog test? And I remember thinking, what, the fog test? I have no idea what that means. And he says, you put a mirror up in front of their face, and if they fog it, you hire them. So meaning that they're breathing, right? So, you know, we've really, I think, thought about recruitment much differently than that. And, you know, we've worked hard, again, to create, to be the employer of choice in the markets where we operate, and to be very intentional about that. And I would encourage providers to do exactly that. Like, there's a lot of options for clinicians out there today. They can go to the hospital, they can go to home health, they can have, you know, flex schedules, all of these different options for them. As I said, there's a finite number of those clinicians. So we need to be really good as a sector, and we need to be really good as a company at being the employer of choice and creating an environment and a culture that is magnetic for those employees to want to be. So I guess that would be maybe rethink number one. You know, rethink number two would be, you know, I've been around the sector long enough also to see that there are those within the sector that have kind of commoditized nursing homes. And what I mean by that is that, you know, they think that growing for growth's sake, you know, will add value to, you know, whatever investment they have. And, you know, we don't think that way. And I really hope that, you know, those who think about nursing homes, think about it, that it really does begin and end with care. You know, real estate, owning the real estate, you know, scaling, that those are all secondary and tertiary strategies that should be executed on once you have tackled your quality of care. And, you know, we've done enough acquisitions over the years for me to say that confidently, mm-hmm. that we need to do a better job as a sector of not commoditizing nursing homes and making sure that we are tackling quality and executing really well and providing high quality care in our facilities. And, you know, once you do that, and once you continue to perform well and can demonstrate that you're performing well, then grow and look for opportunities to expand that influence, that positive influence in the sector. Don't grow for growth's sake. You know, we say that internally a lot. And so I don't know if that's necessarily a rethink or anything that's novel, but, you know, something that's been on my mind that I guess I just share.
Fantastic. Jason, thank you so much. This was a very engaging interview. I appreciate all the time you gave us. That does it for this episode of Rethink. I'd like to remind listeners about our upcoming PAIR Summit taking place June 17th through June 18th in Chicago. The summit will explore how shifting payment models are reshaping the market for skilled nursing and home health. Visit skillednursingnews.com/events to learn more and get tickets. Until next time, thanks for listening.